Okay, let's begin again. We just finished verse 4. Surely hath borne our griefs, carried our sorrows. We discussed the translation of that, and that really more properly understood, it is a reference to the healing ministry of Christ. And then, in spite of that, those who saw his miracles did not understand who he was. We esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted when he was crucified. But let's go on to verse 5. Here's the explanation. Here's the explanation of why he suffered, why he was stricken, why he was smitten. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him. With his stripes we are healed. Verse 5 is the answer to that question of why this one was afflicted, why he suffered. And it's in verse 5 that you have the description of the atonement, not the first half of verse 4. First Peter 2:24 refers back to this as the atoning work of Christ. So verse 5 presents the idea of substitutionary atonement. And you get four statements of that idea included in this one verse. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. And with his stripes we are healed. So you see, you get those four parallel lines, all of them presenting the idea of substitutionary atonement. And that flows on into verse 6. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. The Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. Probably the most familiar verse of the passage, where this idea of substitutionary atonement is continued, and it's made clear that the guilt of our iniquities were what were laid on Christ. The Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. So 5 and 6, substitutionary atonement. Verse 7, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He is brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is done, so he opened not his mouth. You have the similar idea as to what you had in the previous passage in Isaiah 50, verse 6. I gave my back to the smiters, my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. It's voluntary submission. And I think here again is an indication that the one who is described in these verses is not the nation Israel. You know, you get back to that issue of who is the servant? Is it Israel? Is it one distinguished from Israel, individualized? And clearly, this doesn't apply well to Israel. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He's brought as a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep before his shearers is done, so he opened it not his mouth. That statement contrasts with the involuntary suffering of Israel in the exile. In previous chapters in Isaiah, you find the complaints of Israel hardly fit with the statement of this verse. So voluntary submission in verse 7. Verse 8 speaks of the seeming hopelessness of his death. He was taken from prison and from judgment. Who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off out of the land of the living. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. The seeming hopelessness of his death. Who shall declare his generation? He died young. He had no descendants, no posterity. There were a small group of disciples that had been with him during the time of his ministry, but they all deserted him at the time of his death. And he's cut off from the land of the living. It seems hopeless. He's taken from prison, from judgment. Who shall declare his generation? He's cut off out of the land of the living. Then the last phrase, you ask the question, why? Why did this happen? And the last phrase answers that, substitutionary atonement again. It's for the transgression of my people that he was stricken. Somebody had a question a minute ago. Yeah, okay.
Why in when it's looked at with regard to Israel and the left punishment of the trials and difficulties was always required to be exiled? Could it be the wrong application or the later difficulty?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Jewish people would probably look at their whole history as being one of persecution and anti-Semitic actions of one sort or another, and that they are have been subjected to all kinds of abuse.
Is there any sense in which in that history there is a time when they
willingly,
partially willingly, or didn't fight back as much?
Well, I don't know. I guess that issue has been debated somewhat during the German Holocaust as to why the Jews, at least in some places, were fairly passive. But it certainly wasn't universally the case. It certainly isn't the case today. Yes?
You said declare. Can I ask this?
Where are we? Let's see what the word is. It's meditate or consider. Consider for this perhaps a better translation. NIV says, who can speak of his descendants? I think the point is, here's a person who's put to death, and he doesn't have any descendants. So, you know, it seems like that's the end. Let's go on to verse 9. Verse 9, the King James, the first phrase reads, and he made his grave with the wicked, and with the rich in his death. And he made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death. Look at your citations, page 32 again. I've taken a couple more paragraphs from McCrae. He has a very interesting discussion of verse 9 that I think really helps understand or bring out the point that's being made in verse 9 and see how that relates as well to the work of Christ. At the middle of page 32, paragraph there that begins the first half of verse 9, first half of verse 9 is a remarkable prediction of an unusual circumstance that would occur in connection with the crucifixion of Christ. Here the translation, the King James Version, is somewhat inaccurate. When the words are precisely translated, their relation to what occurred at the death of Christ becomes much clearer. This is particularly true of the first clause. Here the King James Version reads, he made his grave, that should be grave, with the wicked. However, the verb used is not ordinarily rendered as make. Its most common translation is give. It's wayitain, very common word, wayitain. Its most common translation is give. It's often used for appointing or assigning. As rendered in the King James Version, it sounds as if the servant himself made his grave. So he says he made his grave with the wicked. Actually, the phrase is impersonal. This is a usage common in many languages, but not usually expressed this way in English. Our idiom would be, they assigned his grave, or his grave was assigned. The word rendered the wicked, you see, he made his grave with the wicked. The word rendered the wicked in the King James is in the plural, but has no article. That is, in the Hebrew, it's in the plural, but has no article. It's rasha'im, it's plural form. It is more accurate to translate it as wicked men, and to render the whole clause, his grave was assigned with wicked men. His grave was assigned with wicked men. See the way that flows. Wayitain et rasha'im. give thee a robe. Since Jesus was crucified between two thieves, it would naturally be expected that he would be buried with them. The Roman custom was either to leave malefactors unburied or to disgrace them by burying a group together in an unclean place. In the King James Version, the verse continues, "and with the rich in his death." The conjunction translated "and" frequently means "but" or "yet," and is often so translated in the King James Version. You have "et." The idea could be expressed by "and," but is brought out more clearly, and the word is translated "but." The word translated "the rich" in the King James Version is in the singular and has no article. Ashir, bimotav. It's in the singular, has no article. It would be more accurately translated as "a rich man." It was a normal expectation that the body of Jesus would be buried with the wicked men who were crucified beside him. Yet his body, instead of being buried with them, was placed in a rich man's tomb, something that could not have occurred except as the result of an appeal by a rich man to Pontius Pilate, Matthew 27:57-60. When the verse is precisely translated, it is easy to see that this prediction was exactly fulfilled in connection with the death of Christ. But you see, it's better translated as he suggests. His grave was assigned with wicked men, but with a rich man in his death. But with a rich man in his death. Read these next two paragraphs. Interpreters who desire to take Isaiah 53 as referring to something other than the sacrifice of Christ find a great stumbling block in the words "rich man." They say they make no sense in the context and suggest the substitution of some other word, such as "evildoers." Yet all the manuscripts agree in reading "a rich man." The reference in the plural to the malefactors with whom he was killed is followed by the singular of the word for "a rich man." In the complete copy of Isaiah that was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Hebrew word for "a rich man" was first written in the plural. And then the plural ending was erased. You can see that on the manuscript. In a bulletin of the American Schools of Oriental Research, Professor Miller Burroughs of Yale pointed out how easily this could happen. The scribe evidently first wrote the word in the plural under the influence of the preceding plural word for wicked men, Rasha'im. And then noticed that the manuscript from which it was copied had "rich men" in the singular, and therefore he erased the plural ending. Thus the Dead Sea Scrolls provide additional evidence of the accuracy of the reading "a rich man" rather than "evildoers." This may be called an inorganic prophecy. Craig talks about inorganic prophecy. Now, what he means by that follows. An organic prophecy is one that predicts how God will accomplish his great purposes. An inorganic prophecy is the prediction of an incidental feature that does not seem directly to further divine objective, but merely serves as a proof that what occurs is actually the event that has been predicted. Burial in a rich man's tomb would not increase the accomplishment of the servant in bearing the guilt of sinful humanity. It's an incidental point. In itself, it doesn't have any significance as far as the atoning work of Christ is concerned. It's an incidental point. Mentioned 700 years in advance, pointing to this particular execution as the one predicted in Isaiah 53. In the providence of God, the fact that Jesus was buried in a fine new tomb on the side of a hill was a divine means for making available convincing evidence of his resurrection. If his body had simply been cast into a felon's grave, the situation might have been quite different. The fact of the empty tomb is one of the great proofs of the resurrection. So, see, that, again, it is an incidental thing that Christ was buried in a rich man's tomb, and yet the amazing way in which this prophecy anticipates precisely what happened in connection with the death of Christ is, I think, a significant confirmation of the fact that fulfillment is to be found with the death and burial of Christ. And I think the suggestions on translation that McCray makes in connection with the first part of verse 9 are helpful in understanding both what is meant and how it relates to the New Testament. McCray says, you see, he says, as rendered in the King James, it sounds as if the servant himself made his grave and wagyatin sounds active. Actually, the phrase is impersonal. This is a usage common in many languages, not usually expressed this way in English. Our idiom would be they assigned his grave. In other words, to make good sense of the way in which that's used in English, you almost have to put it into a passive. His grave was assigned. Well, I think more important is the plural idea. It doesn't have an article, you see, in the Hebrew. So his grave was appointed et rishaim, with wicked men. His grave was appointed with wicked men by virtue of the fact he was crucified with two other criminals. As far as the situation, you would expect that he would be buried with wicked men. His grave was appointed with wicked men. But with a rich man in his death. Switches to the singular. You don't really have the article with either. I think there was an article in Moody Monthly once on that. I couldn't give you a date on it. But it's very similar to what he has in his Gospel of Isaiah book. Alright, let's go on to verse 9. The last phrase of verse 9 really goes more with verse 10 than it does with verse 9. The word translated because, it's al, ayin lamed, really has the idea concerning the fact, with regard to. So you see, concerning the fact that he had done no violence, King James there says because, but concerning the fact that he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth, but it pleased the Lord to bruise him. Now when you read it pleased the Lord to bruise him, I think the word please there is the word that speaks of God's purpose, his foreordination. It was God's pleasure in that sense. This is what he had ordained before the foundation of the world. Salvation will be attained in this way. But concerning the fact that he had done nothing wrong, there was no violence or any deceit in his mouth, nevertheless, it pleased the Lord. It was the Lord's purpose to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. That word grief, chali, is the same word that occurs up in verse 4. Surely he hath borne our griefs. It's that idea of physical pain. He hath put him to grief. You notice that phrase, it pleased the Lord to bruise him, occurs at the end of the verse. It pleased the Lord to bruise him. It was his purpose to put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. The pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. So you get that word pleasure again. God gave his son to die on the cross so that his purposes would be accomplished in his death. The pleasure of the Lord in the sense of his purposes shall prosper in his hand. All right. I think that's the idea, sense of purpose. But you see, the word in Hebrew is hafetz. Hafetz. In English, that word pleasure gives the idea of there was some sort of enjoyment out of it. The emphasis is not that. It's the idea of the eternal purposes of God, his good pleasure. And that's okay. The middle of verse 10, It's an interesting translation question. It doesn't affect greatly meaning, but let's look at it. If you compare King James NIV, New American Standard, and Berkeley, for example, the phrase in the Hebrew is Im Tashim Asham Nefesho. Im Tashim Asham Nefesho. King James says, when thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin. NIV says, and though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering. NASB says, if he would render himself as a guilt offering. Berkeley says, when his soul shall constitute an offering for sin. Question is, in translation, that's where the differences arise for the most part, is what is the subject? Im Tashim Asham Nefesho. If Tashim is the second masculine singular count perfect, then Yahweh is the subject. You have to insert it. See, NIV, though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering. So if Tashim is second masculine singular, then you assume the Lord is the subject. King James says, when thou, second masculine singular, see, the Lord, when thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, the servant's life an offering for sin. But if Tashim is third feminine singular, see, you can't distinguish second masculine, third feminine singular form. They're identical. So it could equally be third feminine singular. If it's third feminine singular, then the nefesho is the subject. See, like the Berkeley, when his soul is feminine. Nefesh is feminine. So if you take this Tashim as third feminine singular, then the nefesho is the subject. And when his soul shall constitute an offering for sin. The question is, you take the nefesho as subject, or you take it as second masculine singular and have the Lord, thou, the Lord, as the subject. As I say, I don't think the conclusion is a whole lot different. You still have substitutionary atonement clearly taught, however you render it. Comment on it. The second masculine singular view, King James NIV, certainly possible. Yahweh often found as the subject of sin. But, and here's where I would feel there's a real question about that translation. This causes a change in subject from third to second person in the context. You see, it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. Are you going to change then from third to second person? If you take the third feminine singular imperfect, then you don't have that change in subject to second person. When you continue on as it has been, it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When his soul shall constitute an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, prolong his days. The pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. So just an interesting question of ambiguity, really, that arises because of the verbal form as far as the question of what is the subject. I would prefer that his soul as being the subject, or his life. And that brings up another interesting. Just took a paragraph out of BBB there, under Asham, sin offering. He comments, this offering seems to have been confined to offenses against God or man that could be estimated and so covered by compensation. An ordinary trespass offering was a ram, together with restitution and a penalty of a fifth of its value. And then I won't read all that, but notice the last line. The messianic servant offers himself as an asham in compensation for the sins of the people, interposing for them as their substitute. Isaiah 53:10. That's page 31 in your citation. The messianic servant offers himself as an asham, a sin offering. Notice the relation to Leviticus 17:11 as well. Leviticus 17:11, the key verse in Leviticus, says, "For the life of the flesh is in the blood." And that's the word nephesh, the word life. So the life of the flesh is in the blood. "I've given it to you upon the altar, make an atonement for your nephashot, for your souls, your lives. For it is the blood that maketh an atonement for the soul," nephesh. The word nephesh, or singular plural, occurs three times in Leviticus 17:11. And here you see it's nephashot, his life, shall constitute an asham, a sin offering. So the life of this servant constitutes a sin offering. That's, I would say, one of the clearest statements of substitutionary atonement in the chapter. We have a number of them in the chapter, but that's a forceful one. His life, his nephesh, constitutes an asham, a sin offering. The next phrase is, "He shall see his seed." That gives a statement about the result of the servant sacrifice. Verse 8 said, "He was cut off from the land of living. Who shall declare his generation?" He had no descendants. Yet here it is said that as a result of the offering that he shall make, he shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days. So he will have a posterity. His days seem to be cut off. But here it says that he shall prolong his days. I think here you have a hint of the resurrection. That even though he was put to death, he will live again. So he shall see his seed. There will be a posterity. Now, of course, I think what that is referring to is the redeemed people, those who were the benefactors from the work that he did, those who put their trust in his work. All right, verse 11. "He shall see the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquity." You can ask a question about that second phrase, "By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many." Is that the knowledge the servant possesses, by his knowledge? Or is it the knowledge of the servant on the part of others? In other words, it's the question of the objective or subjective genitive. I think most likely the "his" is to be taken as an objective rather than subjective genitive. And so the phrase means "by the knowledge of him." See, his knowledge. "By the knowledge of him." That is, their knowledge of what he did. By that knowledge, the servant will declare many righteous. Yes. "For he shall bear their iniquity." All right, the last verse. "Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong." And then you get several summary statements. "Because he had poured out his soul unto death, he was numbered with the transgressors, he bore the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. I think the last phrases are quite clear. You get repetition of ideas that have been already expressed in the chapter. The first part of the verse, though, is one that's often caused some difficulty in understanding. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. Look at page 29 of your citation. I'm inclined to read this the way Alexander suggests in his commentary. Bottom of page 29, Alexander says, it is better, therefore, to adopt the usual construction sanctioned by Calvin, Gesenius, and Ewalt, which suppose him to be described as equal to the greatest conquerors. In other words, you have an idiom here in which the servant is pictured as a conqueror. If this is not enough, or if the sense is frigid as Martini alleges, it is not the fault of the interpreter, who has no right to strengthen the expressions of his author by means of forced construction. Here's what Alexander suggests. The simple meaning of the first clause is that he shall be triumphant, not that others shall be sharers in his victory. You know, when it says he shall divide the spoil with the strong. Simple meaning is he shall be triumphant, not that others shall be sharers in his victory, but that he shall be as gloriously successful in his enterprise as other victors ever were in theirs. You often get a question of interpreters that try to take this in a more detailed, literal way. Who is the strong that he's going to divide the spoils with? And you get into all kinds of discussions on that. Alexander sort of sidesteps that by saying the imagery used in the first clause of verse 12 is simply that Christ is going to be successful and victorious in the work that he has been given to do. And the imagery that's used is that of a conquering leader or king. And the simple idea is he is triumphant. Okay, I see it's 10 of 9. Oh, 10 of 9. It's really 10 of 10. Yeah. It's a great chapter. That brings us, as I mentioned, to the end of the servant passages. From this point on, you read of servants in the plural, but not again of the servants. So, well, then we look at the results of the servant's work. Midterm is on Friday. Friday. It'll come up to this point. I didn't go back and check on reading. There wasn't any reading notes. No. So it's just on lecture material up to this point. Bring an English and a Hebrew Bible. Not sure whether you'll use it for all the tests, but probably for some of it. Past the midterm, I'll probably spend one session on 54, 55, and 56.